the Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Present.
Mariani present. Chair Frazier or Vice Chair Frazier?
Present.
Frazier present. Representative Johnson?
Present.
Johnson present. Representative Edelson?
Present.
Edelson present. Representative Feist?
Present.
Feist present. Representative Grossel?
Here.
Grossel present. Representative Hollins?
Present.
Hollins present. Representative Hewitt? Representative Hewitt? Representative Cleavorn? Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn present.
Cleavorn present. Representative Long?
Present.
Long present. Representative Lucero?
Happy post-lunch.
Lucero present. Representative Mueller?
Present.
Mueller present. Representative Novotny?
Novotny present.
Novotny present. Representative O'Neill? Representative O'Neill?
Present.
O'Neill present. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Pinto present. Representative Poston?
Present.
Poston present. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh present.
Raleigh present. Representative Vang?
Present.
Vang present. Representative Zhang?
Present.
Zhang present. Representative Hewitt?
So I think Hewitt present.
Hewitt present. That concludes the roll.
Very well, members. The quorum is present. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic, requiring public health exercise of social distancing. Members, you'll notice that we have Laura with us today as the clerk. Our regular person, Caitlin, is out ill today, and so sending her healing thoughts, and hopefully you can all join me in that as well. Members, today we're going to, we won't be hearing a bill today. We will hear presentations on law enforcement in greater Minnesota. The chair believes, and actually we all know, that there's been tremendous demographic changes constantly shifting across our state, and that, quite frankly, there isn't a corner of our state that isn't experiencing that change. One of the main features of that change is the cultural diversity and racial diversity that's growing across our state. There are other changes as well, economic shifts, tax base issues, there are aging issues in terms of the population, and then there are aging issues in terms of our facilities as well. All of those are important factors for us as legislators to constantly take into account as we make important decisions that govern the state of Minnesota. One of the constant important issues is for us to strongly resource our public safety law enforcement efforts everywhere in the state, and paying particular attention to how these demographic shifts especially are impacting the work, changing the work, challenging the work of our local public safety entities. Next week, we'll start hearing some bills where the chair will be hearing, introducing and hearing bills to make investments for law enforcement efforts, both to advance excellence and accountability throughout the state. This is a big state. One of the earliest jobs I had was working for a statewide ecumenical body 30 plus years ago. It allowed me to travel pretty much throughout the entire state. It made a tremendous impact on a young person. I was young once in terms of the incredible diversity and size of our state. And so one of the things I've learned early, and I think we all learn here as legislators, is that while there are constant same issues and work that the state of Minnesota must tend to, that there are also very distinct realities that occur throughout our state. And public safety is not immune from that distinctiveness, whether it's in policing and corrections, in community engagement work, or programming to be part of public safety. There are distinct issues, and my hope is that we'll be able to be responsive for all of those. So today we're going to be hearing, today and tomorrow, we'll be hearing specifically on Greater Minnesota perspectives on that. Today we'll hear from public safety professionals, both from a state perspective as well as a local perspective on the distinct issues and challenges in policing, corrections, community work, and programming work. Tomorrow we'll hear from Greater Minnesota community members, especially local Greater Minnesota communities of color, as well as hearing from those who are professionals in providing local programming. So members, hopefully we'll have a good opportunity for a question and answering throughout both of those hearings. Very quickly, members, just a word about our schedule. As we're plotting out the number of bills that are coming toward us, I want to share this. The chair still intends to avoid evening hearings if at all possible. It may not be possible. So just a heads up on that. But you know what my intent is. And then also, please expect that we will be availing ourselves of our Friday slot that was reserved for this committee on a regular basis between now and the end of deadlines. So members, with that, we're going to move to the first part of today's presentation. And actually, I do see a few hands up. I apologize. I need to scroll up and down here. Minority Leader Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, just a couple quick things. One, a little disappointed that our side of the aisle did not receive any information about the testifiers, the information they were going to provide until 11:33 this morning. I know if we'd wanted to get a testifier on it and find out the information, what's going on, we either have to go on the website to see if it's there, or we have no idea even if we want to have some people to testify on this side of the aisle. It's impossible for us to get that information because we have no clue what's going on. We're not provided any information up front, what it's going to be discussed other than the main topic. We have no idea who the presenters are. I guess we would like to be able to, if we choose to, have some rebuttal on this information, have testifiers that can also testify maybe on a different point of view. And the material that was given out today at 11:33, we would have not have found out about it because we did not receive an email on it till then, and it was already up on the public screen before that on the website. So I'm just asking that if in the future, if you could provide this information as soon as you get it, so we can also prepare and be ready for these committee meetings, so we're able to ask pointed, very thought-out questions to make sure the public understands what's going on. I'm just asking that out of common courtesy. And then also, I want to thank you for a very good committee meeting on Tuesday. Unfortunately, you had promised Representative O'Neill a moment at the end to make a couple comments she wished to have made. but she was not able to do that. So I'm asking if you could give her the opportunity to do that now.
Representative Johnson, there's a lot there. You and the public certainly have my ongoing commitment to be transparent as early as possible. That's been the history of my chairmanship of this committee. I will continue to do that. You and I should probably take part of this conversation offline. I'm being informed by my staff that, in fact, notices have been sent to you, and so maybe something's breaking down there. But that's the information that I have, and my intent. As to Representative O'Neill's comments, members, when we run out of time, we run out of time. The Zoom platform is not going to allow us to hang around. I am certainly willing to hang around and have Zoom conversation, if that's what you want to have. I'm open to doing that. But members, we can only ask as many questions and have as much discussion as this platform will allow us to have. And quite frankly, even when we're here in person, that's true as well. Oftentimes these committee hearings are followed by other committee hearings that are using the same room. So I would ask us all to work together to be as concise as possible. Making sure that we're always allowing room for other members to be able to speak as well. You have my ongoing commitment to get as many voices in as possible. We do have an agenda today. It is the chair's intent to get through our agenda. If there is time at the end, we will use that time in order to continue to have other conversation that members wish to have. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a quick question back on the evening hearings. Is it the chair's preference to have evening hearings or Friday hearings?
First of all, Representative Lucero, I'm feeling the brown hat. Representative Lucero, it would be my preference to have Friday hearings. And the reason for that is that time has been reserved from the very beginning for us. So it's a heck of a lot easier to line up. Using the Zoom platform, and by now all members, should have that on their calendar. Whereas having a Friday evening, I doubt any of us have those on our calendar right now. You know, we may need to break down and do that. It is my hope that we don't. But we do process a lot of bills, and sometimes there are conversations that are, going to take longer. And so, again, I would ask all members to be as concise as possible. Representative Lucero, my preference is those Friday meetings. Very well. Thank you, members. With that, we're going to move into the first part of this conversation and sharing. This will be an overview of state law enforcement efforts in greater Minnesota. So we'll be looking at, for instance, the VSET program and human trafficking task force presentation. We have three state level officials from BCA, or rather from, it does include the BCA, from public safety with us today, Commissioner John Harrington, BCA Superintendent Drew Evans, and the Director of the Office of Justice Programs, Kate Weeks. And so with that, I'll call on our Commissioner, Commissioner Harrington, to get us started.
Chair, this is Katie Knudsen from the Department of Public Safety. I apologize for the confusion. The commissioner's not here today. The superintendent and the director are here to go over the agenda you wish to cover.
Very well. Thank you. Good to see you, Ms. Knudsen. Perhaps Director Evans.
Good afternoon, and I'm going to kick it right over to Director Weeks. So we're going to give a presentation. Director Kate Weeks is, as you know, the director of the Office of Justice Programs, who oversees the funding for a number of these programs in the state. And then I'll jump in and certainly there to answer any questions. I'm involved in the activities she's discussing today as well.
Super. Welcome to the committee, Director Weeks. Always good to see you.
Morning, Chair, or good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for having us here today. I will be kicking off the presentation. Primarily because our office is the grant makers to these task forces that we're going to be hearing about today. So we look to start with our human or sex trafficking investigations. So we can go to the next slide. The funding for the human trafficking task forces began through the legislature in 2015. And over the next couple of years, more state investment has been made in these task forces. Currently, we fund four, one at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension with Superintendent Evans diving a little bit more into that. We have a task force with the Fond du Lac Band, primarily called the Trust Task Force. There is a task force, including the Stearns County Attorney General's Office, as a Central Minnesota Sex Trafficking Task Force. And then there's also one in the East Metro based out of the Washington County Sheriff's Department. Primarily, the funds for the task forces support analysts, overtime, investigators, training, and some travel. And we can go to the next slide. So the impact of these task forces are having an impact through the state of Minnesota. As you can see, 1,260 reports have been taken. 323 of the reports involved a juvenile, and 354 of the investigations resulted in cases. Next slide. Currently, the task forces receive a lot of their information through referrals. As you can see, the task forces throughout the state receive referrals from a variety of ways. It could be child protection, social services, victim referrals, referral from other law enforcement, school, and school liaisons who have a lot of contact with kids or are going to notice when kids are not present. The next slide. And this next slide confirms a lot of what you heard on Tuesday with the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. Investigations don't necessarily result in charges, and charges don't necessarily result in convictions. And so you can kind of see the typical charges that are involved in investigations that we are seeing. And Superintendent Evans can probably dive in a little bit more with the work that the BCA is doing.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I thought you were deferring to Superintendent Evans. He'll do that later.
Yes, sorry about that. I was just pulling up some statistics that might be helpful for the committee to know. Even though I don't want people to be disheartened at these numbers, because these task forces are having a huge impact. 73 adult and juvenile victim recovery operations. We had, for victim information, 404 adult sex trafficking victims, 133 youth sex trafficking victims, 237 of these juveniles were determined to be high risk. And what we are seeing too is repeat interactions with victims, which is another issue that was raised on Tuesday. And these statistics show that. And these are just statistics from the four task forces that we have. This is not all encompassing of what is happening in Minnesota. And I think the committee heard some of that on Tuesday as well, as data is sparse, and that is an area that we should probably be focusing on in the state of Minnesota to try and get a good sense of what is happening ongoing. Sorry for the disjointed presentation on my part, but I have my papers in order now. But I would like to hand it over to Superintendent Evans that can do a deeper dive into what the BCA Human Trafficking Task Force is doing.
Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And for members of the task force, the goal of this portion is to give you an idea on a more pragmatic or on a more localized level exactly how these task forces are operating across the state. Our mission statement for our human trafficking task force is to provide coordinated and collaborated statewide assistance with human trafficking investigations, prosecutions, victim recoveries, trainings through a victim-centered approach. Really taking a very holistic approach to human trafficking investigations, in particular, sex trafficking investigations, which really this work is focused on. These investigators, through some of our other work here at the BCA, do focus on a limited basis on some of the other human trafficking activities, such as wage theft related, forced work, servitude, some other things like that. But the funded task force focuses on sex trafficking. The way this one was formed at the BCA was that we were having conversations at the time when we first started with, in particular, the St. Paul and Minneapolis Police Departments, who really do have a long history and expertise of conducting these types of investigations. We do the work at the BCA as well. And then we joined forces with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office, Hennepin County, Homeland Security Investigations, who focus on this type of work at the federal level, the BCA, and then the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I share the full-time members and why they're there is because this work in Minnesota, as Director Weeks noted, there's a big impact, but there's also very limited resources, even with the largest of agencies in the state, focusing on this type of work. Part of that is that there is a certain level of expertise that comes along with doing these types of investigations, and they're often, when we talk about going into them, they're much more like a longer-term RICO conspiracy investigation than they are some of the other types of violent crime investigation that we do, meaning that they're often interconnected, they're multi-jurisdictional, they often involve large numbers of victims that are coordinated sometimes by a criminal enterprise, sometimes by one individual. And so it really takes the number of members that we see here plus our affiliates. And then the reason we have the Ramsey County Attorney's Office is they are sometimes very complex in the terms of the schemes and the way that the trafficking operation is occurring. So we have an embedded county attorney here at the BCA with the task force to provide us guidance and legal advice as we're working through these investigations. And they've been a really invaluable partner along with the full-time members. Next slide, please. Sorry, I'm trying to change on this. What the structure is and what it does and the value to doing this and why task forces, and we'll talk about the VSETs later, are so valuable in terms of pooling our resources is we use one case management system. Minnesota has many different, I think we have currently 14 different types of case management systems, but we have 430 or so law enforcement agencies, meaning 430 or so different databases with information in the state. And the goal is to connect cases, connect suspicious activities, connect suspicious incidents with possible traffickers so that we can share that information amongst the task force members. We also use the same system as our counterparts, which is called the Wisconsin Division of Criminal Investigation in Wisconsin, so we can readily share. The systems aren't connected, but we can readily share information on a need-to-know basis. We use one deconfliction system, meaning that we are deconflicting with law enforcement and the other task forces across the state to determine if anybody's working on a particular individual and if they've had other contact with potential victims that we may recover in the process. Then we have a commander to review and approve our reports, plans, and to have a really focused approach. And then we have that statewide coverage. And then in particular, the statewide coverage and that we work with along with the other three task forces, I do want to highlight for the committee the importance of the Safe Harbor Regional Navigator Program. We work hand in hand with the Regional Navigator Program in all of our casework that we're working on. And in particular, we do things right down to if we're running an operation that we're trying to rescue victims through an operation, we have a navigator right there with us from the Safe Harbor Program, ready to offer services to the victims to try to make sure that we really have that victim-centered approach that we're conducting these investigations with. You can move. In fact, next slide is fine, Katie, but we're even working currently with a number of different programs across the state, but we're also looking how to even improve the service delivery. And one of the programs we work with regularly is currently applying for a grant to have an advocate that they would embed with this task force. So it would work with that program, but then we would have an advocate right on site so that we can work with victims across Minnesota, providing the services they do. The PASS protocol, the National Human Trafficking Hotline, why I bring this up and Kate alluded to the hotline tips that came in the earlier statistics. One of the challenges that we faced, and if I had Bobby Joe Pasnick is one of our experts in this field, agent assigned, she shares a story often when it comes to this about how an individual victim had contacted wanting to be provided services and escape the trafficker that was trafficking this individual. And they were passed around through several different jurisdictions in the process, mainly because the expertise wasn't there. Law enforcement wasn't ready to respond because it's not something they focus on day in, day out. And so it took a couple different times before this individual who ended up getting victimized more than once before it got to really the law enforcement had expertise in this field, and we were able to rescue that individual. Part of that is making sure there's a centralized vetting process. And so we now take in all the tips that come into the hotline. It's a nationwide hotline. They come all into the BCA currently, into our task force, and then a number of people on the task force vet them. And then we work closely. If it's under the jurisdiction of the other task forces Kate alluded to, they often will take that tip and then they will work that in their jurisdiction. If it's in a jurisdiction that has expertise but isn't part of a task force, they may take that investigation, or we may assist them. Or if they don't have the expertise and ability to address it, then our task force will go work that case and provide the services that we can and investigate that. Part of that is for us why we were asked by the partners to lead. We have that 24/7 statewide coverage, but those partners that we said, it truly is a task force. Even though the BCA leads it, it's a task force that encompasses the whole state. You can go to the next slide. When it comes to large events, and we put this in because we think you may have questions on this, you see things like the Super Bowl, NCAA, PGA tournament, the pipeline that's currently going across Minnesota. It highlights more than really creates a situation. It doesn't bring more trafficking to the state necessarily. It highlights in any large-scale event that trafficking is occurring in our state all the time. And so we do create operations surrounding those because we know more people will be in a particular area or attending a particular event. But again, the traffickers specifically go where the demand is. So a lot of people are here. The traffickers are going to go where there's demand, whether it's here or in different places across the country. And so we look at these and what we're typically doing in these situations is we're conducting two types of operations: proactive suppression operations, where we're typically posing as a trafficked victim and a sex buyer is coming, meeting us as law enforcement because they're trying to purchase sex from another human being, or we are working on victim rescue operations where we are posing as a sex buyer and then we attempt to rescue the victim by providing resources, different ways of whether it's shelter, whether it's advocacy programs, whatever it may be, so that we are able to rescue these. And then we spin out of those often. Those rescue operations are often how we are identifying the trafficking operation. And then our goal is to pursue criminally the person that is trafficking these human beings. You can go to the next slide. And this, with this, I think this is probably a good point to pause, Kate, unless we want to take questions at the end. If there's questions, it's a very high overview of human trafficking. What we would say when it comes to this is that it exists everywhere in our state. And to your focus today, Chair Mariani, about Metro versus Greater Minnesota, there is no particular jurisdiction, region of the state that does not have human trafficking occurring in it. Occurs all over the state of Minnesota. We also say that, you know, part of our collective duty is to work collectively to change society and make sure it's really known and to our children as they're growing up and to everybody that it's never okay to purchase another human being for sex. And that's our goal to either do through criminal investigations, but also through outreach, PSAs, et cetera, with OJP and discussions they've had. We brought This task force folds in at times. I should have noted earlier, I have the Predatory Crimes Unit at the BCA that does online exploitation of children, child pornography investigations in particular, and then they work on these human trafficking cases as well. Part of the reason we work with them together is we also have in that child exploitation or our Internet Crimes Against Children task force, we have we're in the process of bringing on board an education coordinator to provide education materials and coordination to our schools across Minnesota. We recently began having some conversations about how it may make some sense to do the same thing if we can figure out some protocols and funding mechanisms with our with the same thing with human trafficking, because that's where we all need to start, is educating everybody in our state about why this is not okay as an activity.
Director Evans, I know we're also going to talk about some other areas, I think perhaps about the VSET. And, you know, members, we could spend an entire day talking about, and probably should, if we could, on human trafficking. However, let me do this right now. Let me just stop. I'll come back to your presentation. Let me stop and do a few questions specifically on this area. We do have a couple of members that, you know, your presentation have triggered some questions. One of the things that I'm looking for is whether or not, so I'm hearing a message, human trafficking, present everywhere. You know, it's not a, you know, unique to any region of the state. Therefore, important to have a strong centralized law enforcement service component. And it sounds like the way we do that is to effectively look for effective ways to partner with, you know, the state partnering with local law enforcement. And over the years, you know, developing tactics and tools to be able to do that effectively. So one of the things I'm looking for is, even with that, what might still be the gaps and the distinct that speak to the distinctive nature of any of these crime-fighting efforts based on geography, you know, distance, lack of resources, training, you know, whatever that might be. But that's a real broad question, so I'm just going to have that plant that as you answer the following questions from our members. First, we'll have Representative Grasso and then Representative Feist. Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for being here today, Superintendent Evans and Director Weeks. I've worked with both of you in the past in my former life as a task force agent on both the federal and state task forces. You know, spending 6 years on those, with those groups and in the environment of gangs, guns, violent crime, narcotics trafficking, all of it, it leaves a mark and something that you always strive for to stop. So thank you for continuing this work and is greatly appreciated. And yes, it is statewide and it is an ugly thing. I guess for my first question, I got a couple questions, Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge me.
Mr. Grasso, but I do want to notify folks, we do want to move on in a few minutes to the other part as well. But yes, please go ahead, your first question.
Yes, for Director or Superintendent Evans, I guess, or Director Weeks, but are there any cases, you know, specifically because I live up here and have been working hard to get this pipeline project moving across Minnesota for our local trades workers and so on. Are there any cases of trafficking that are developing or that you guys, well, I mean, if something under investigation, you can't say anyway, but are you seeing any issues with the actual pipeline project at this point?
Director Evans.
Chair Mariani and Representative Grasso, thank you for the question. What I can say is that there is a well-developed plan that was created with the Trust Task Force, the Tribes United Against Sex Trafficking, and our statewide task force working in partnership to monitor whether or not there are any concerns or issues developing across the northern tier of the state associated with construction. I can tell you that this task force is very busy. I do not have specific examples, as you note, that if it's under active investigation, but we will be watching and monitoring closely for sex trafficking across the northern tier of our state. And I will tell you that we have cases really all over the state of Minnesota right now, if I'll answer it that way. Chair Mariani, just to hit on your point, when it comes to, and I think Representative Grasso is hitting this from his experiences on a task force, you answered the question for me in terms of that is exactly what we all need all the time is training, it's a big state, as we all know, large geographically, so it's difficult. We work very closely with our partners across Minnesota. There's some police agencies that are, you know, two people, there's seven people, you know, that cover the whole county. And so that's a challenge no matter where we are. And that's why we pool these resources through the VSETs we're going to talk about in a little bit, and in our human trafficking. And I neglected to say, and of course, I don't have the number in front of me, our task force also operates in the way to expand that reach in terms of affiliates. We do an ICAC model. So they don't have full-time participation, but they participate in our monthly meetings. So they hear the same type of information. We all learn together collectively as law enforcement. We provide training. And I believe we're up to 30 or 40 different task force affiliates across Minnesota. So it's a much larger reach. And that goes, I'm looking at the map in front of me, from Thief River Falls and the far northwest corner of the state to Rochester PD in our southeastern corner and all across the middle. So that's another thing I wanted to know.
Very well. Representative Grassl, a quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess would be along those same lines. You know, are there any man camps along this pipeline route? Because the last I checked, there were none. And that was something that was of concern to me, because these are local people, our local trades workers that are benefiting from these jobs that have come into our state, this private investment. And that was something that I stayed on top of them about, to say, you know, so that we could dispel some of the rhetoric from people that were against the pipeline. And man camps were one of those things that were that was being used to try to stop these jobs from coming to our state. So, I mean, that is something that I've stayed on top of myself to check with. Are you finding any of that?
Director Evans.
Chair Mariani, Representative Grassl, they are expressly prohibited, I think, of what you're alluding to in the permitting process for the Line 3. So we are watching to make sure they do not, because of that reason. They have caused challenges in different states, and so that's why this is a very good thing to have. Part of the reason I say we are watching to ensure that they do not pop up is there is stress on the hotel system across northern Minnesota, because there's a large number of people in our state right now. But no, to answer your question specifically, we are not aware of any man camps and associated with Line 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Representative Grassl. Then we have Representative Johnson, then we'll move on to the conversation on VSETs. So, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Director Evans, I want to thank you for being here. I've enjoyed the time I've worked with you here, and also in my career in law enforcement. You're very good to work with, and I hope to keep that continuing, because you've done a fantastic job. Chair Mariani, a little bit to answer your question you had about some of the difficulties that are have setting up these task forces.
Well, you are an expert, Representative Johnson.
I was a member of the task force that when I got done, it imploded on itself, not because of the guys that are working there. The men that work these task force, these officers, they are fantastic. They are very dedicated. They want to make sure that what they're doing is utmost proper and done respectfully, because the goal is to put the bad guys in jail, get the drugs or the Johns off the street, and make sure that there are no victims. Where the issue comes is usually, especially in greater Minnesota, a one county can't do it. It takes multiple counties. And to do that, they have to set up joint power boards. And that's where the problem comes in, because it's usually county commissioners or city council or police chiefs to get their nose in a wrinkle, because they are not involved, or that they didn't get their way. And that's usually what blows them up. So we have to find a way to do these in a way that we can make sure they're done properly, have the proper oversight, but still keeping that local control. And that's the delicate balance that we have to work on. I think Director Evans understands exactly what I'm saying.
I appreciate that, Representative Johnson. And we will be hearing shortly from some local people as well. I suspect they may be echoing some of your comments. Superintendent Evans, if you can continue then, please.
And I will, I'll turn over to the Director Weeks here. I do completely agree with those comments. And we don't run very many task forces at the BCA. We were asked to run this one. And we have a collaborative group of people that come together to set that strategy, just as Representative Johnson noted, so that it isn't us guiding everything. It's providing that leadership, but we are working with our partners. And it always needs to be a collaborative approach. So I'll turn it back over to Director Weeks.
Super. Thank you. Director Weeks.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent Evans. Chair members, the next task force that we'll be talking about is under the Violent Crime Coordinating Council, which oversees violent crime enforcement teams throughout the state. In 2010, the Minnesota legislature established the council to provide guidance related to the investigation and prosecution of gang and drug crimes. The council provides direction and oversight to the multi-jurisdictional VSETs located throughout the state. The statutory authority is Minnesota Statute 299A.642, and it encompasses all of the regulations and direction for these operations. Currently in Minnesota, we have 21 violent crime enforcement teams covering 70 counties with over 200 full-time investigators. The VSETs grants for this past round was approximately $4.8 million. $3.8 million of that is state funds, and we do use $550,000 in federal funds. The task force structure, I'll spend a little time kind of talking over that. More of it can be found in the statute. A violent crime enforcement team is comprised of law enforcement officers from agencies within the multi-jurisdictional area. Is established to provide coordinated joint investigation of controlled substance violations, gang activity, and other felony level criminal activity within the jurisdiction. Each task force has a governing board, which consists of chief law enforcement officers or designees from the participating agencies, as well as a prosecutor from that jurisdiction. And the board is responsible for all the overall management and budget of the task force, establishing mission and goals, and monitoring the process towards those goals. A member of that board is also appointed to serve as the executive director to monitor day-to-day operations of the task force. The task force commander is assigned by the board and is responsible for making sure that all policies and protocols are followed. Task force requirements currently are the VSET must be comprised of at least three separate law enforcement agencies. Multi-county VSETs are required in counties with a population of less than 100,000. This is due to enhance resource sharing, interagency coordination, and information exchange about the investigations that they're conducting. The VSET must be under the operational director of a full-time commander or team leader, and at least three full-time officers must be assigned and co-located, which also increases communication. The VSETs target violent offenders and felonies that have a likelihood of being related to the distribution of drugs or other cases that have a significant multi-jurisdictional impact. The VSET has to operate within accordance of the multi-jurisdictional task force operating procedures, and they all follow the same guidelines manual. Another important piece that I would like to share is all of the VSETs do participate in deconfliction software so that they are communicating that way as well. All VSETs have to adhere to all criminal law and policies in the state, including related to forfeiture and seizure of cash and property. And all VSETs are reviewed annually for compliance with certification and other guidance provided by the Violent Crime Coordinating Council, which meets on a regular basis each year. Currently, we are finalizing the Violent Crime Coordinating Council report to the legislature, where we'll capture a lot of the information that's happened in the past year and talk a little bit more about trends that the VSETs are seeing across Minnesota. Some of the highlights are meth labs are down from 410 in 2003 to less than 20 in the last several years. arrests have been down, but the amount that these task forces are seeing are increasing exponentially, which is showing that Minnesota is shifting from a drug destination to a drug distribution center for the upper Midwest. And traffickers are now using more technology than they have in the past for tracking. And that is a high level overview of the VSET program in the state of Minnesota. I know that Superintendent Evans also sits on the Violent Crime Coordinating Council. If there are other specific questions as well, Superintendent and I can answer those questions.
Yeah, we do have one question, and then I'm hoping you'll hang around because I do want to get our testifiers from Chisago and Renville in sooner than later. So members, you know, if you have questions on VSETs, we'll try to get back to that. But very quickly, and there is a question for Representative Pinto, but very quickly, can you just quickly tell me to what degree do the Crime Coordinating Councils, to what degree does their work involve any kind of coordination around the preventative end of this issue? Is there much overlap there, communications back and forth, or is it really focused on, hey, let's get right here, right now, let's stop these distributors and or transfers of drugs and perpetrators of violent crime. Superintendent Evans.
Yeah, I can attempt to answer. So there are prevention efforts that are a required part of the grant process. And so and in particular, you know, educational, working with the community partners, that's encouraged on behalf of the VSET, of the Violent Crime Coordinating Council to all of our 21 VSETs. There's also information sharing in terms of how to do that with best practices. They have a regular commanders meeting that OJP hosts and brings together with particular topics and with our drug and gang oversight coordinator for the state. So it's creating those connections and prevention activities. Certainly the treatment and community-based programs are much more involved in that type of work, but they certainly have a connection to all that work.
Okay, I got lots of follow-ups, but we'll do that offline and or at a next hearing. Representative Pinto, and then we'll move on to our local folks. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question connects kind of both parts of the presentation from the presenters. And first, I want to just add to the praise. I've had a lot of chance to work with Superintendent Evans and Director Weeks, and just really am so grateful to them for working with me and for all that they do. You had the slide that showed that it's about $4.8 million being spent annually on the VSETs, so investigating drug and gun cases, of which $3.7 million is state money. I didn't find a slide, and if you can just remind me, I think it's sort of in the $1 million range or so on the human trafficking side of things. And if you could just give me a sense of that.
Director Evans or Director Weeks.
Yes, Chair, members, Representative Pinto, in 2015, I believe that the initial funding was $250,000. And then it increased in 2016 with another additional $820,000. And I believe another investment was made in fiscal year 2017, and it's up around $1 million.
And this is specifically on the human trafficking?
Human trafficking.
Okay. Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Weeks. Director Weeks, I actually remember the $250,000 really well because I was presenting it to this committee at that point for that amount of money. And I probably praise past Chair Cornish for seeing this and taking my proposal and including it kind of the last second in the budget. And I'm so glad it's grown quite a bit. I guess I will just point out to committee members, though, we're spending about four times as much money, actually five times as much money, dealing with the trafficking of drugs and of guns as we are the trafficking of people. And it may be that we want to try to rectify that and address that, recognizing that there is human trafficking everywhere in our state. And just to reiterate from my work training cops in this area and other things that it really is every corner of the state in all kinds of ways. So yeah, I really appreciate that, and hopefully we can keep an eye on that. I guess I'll just note one other thing. There is a coordinator of the violent crime of the VSETs that works in your office, Director Weeks, and that, I suppose the cost for that is kind of on top of the grants as well. There's not a similar coordinator on the human trafficking side. And might there be a benefit in to have that as we're on the human trafficking side as well, possibly?
Superintendent Evans?
I certainly
one and five.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Mariani. See the value in the VSET program. I mean, there are 21 VSETs, certainly, though, that provides a level of consistency. And they do a lot of work on the policy work related to this, ensuring that we have a policy manual. Some of the similar work is being done, but it's more organic. We're very closely connected with the Minnesota Department of Health, who've been working on different protocols, but certainly, coordination across different entities. We certainly see the value in the gang and drug oversight coordinator that works, that we have a connection with at the BCA as well, that's housed in OJP.
Well, Representative Pinto, hopefully a conversation.
Thank you.
We will continue.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
We did have a bit of this conversation last biennium. It does seem to me that the more we're learning about sexual human trafficking, I think there's a real strong argument to be made here about beefing up our administration, coordination, and resources for this to combat this horrible crime. Members, we're going to push on. We do have, and thank you, Superintendent Evans and Director Weeks. I want to echo comments from a number of colleagues here about the quality of your work and the importance of what you do. Thank you. And please stick around. All right. With that, we're going to have an overview of law, local law enforcement efforts in greater Minnesota from local law enforcement folks. We do have Sheriff Scott Habel, and I hope I pronounced that right. If I didn't, please correct me, who is the Renville County Sheriff, then followed by Janet Ryder, the Chisago County Attorney. So welcome to the committee, Sheriff.
Thank you so much, Chair Mariani. Members of the committee, are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Again, by way of introduction, my name is Scott Habel. I'm the sheriff in Renville County. We're a small rural county about 100 miles straight west of the Twin Cities. Olivia is our county seat. Land size-wise, we're actually one of the bigger counties. We're at about 1,000 square miles. However, population-wise, we're not that big at all, only about 15,000 people. I'm currently in my third term as Renville County Sheriff, and probably like you, my passion is to serve with every bit of my might. The people who've entrusted me to this office and wear their sheriff badge. I'm a board member at the Sheriff's Association here in Minnesota. I represent Greater Minnesota Sheriffs on the Violent Crimes Coordinating Council that you just talked about, and similarly was appointed twice by Governor Dayton and currently serve on the EMS Regulatory Board representing Minnesota's sheriffs. It's my honor, honestly, to be here among you today. I've been asked to provide some information, some insight, perhaps, into rural law enforcement services delivery from the perspective of an outside sheriff. And so hopefully I can give you some information as to what's going right and maybe what our challenges are. So I've been asked to focus on five or six different areas, and maybe I'll begin with what's maybe not going so great. I know it's not unique to rural Minnesota, but one of our most significant challenges is trying to take care of the mentally ill. The system that we have in place today to take care of this population is badly, badly broken. A typical scenario includes our deputies responding to some sort of an event, realizing that a mental illness is in play. They ultimately transport these folks to our local hospital for a medical and physical evaluation. If warranted, our medical providers are signing holds on these patients. And then the game begins, really. multiple phone calls to various facilities across the state, essentially begging someone to take on these mental health cases, usually to no avail. And oftentimes hours and hours later, like 12 hours is not out of the question. Finally, these patients in many cases move. Unfortunately, lots of times they move outside the state of Minnesota. Those several hours are hours that our deputies and police officers are spending in the hospital. Now, a small organization like mine, we maybe only have one or two deputies on at a time. And so to take one of those out of service to stand at the hospital with a mental health patient is taxing on us, to say the least. Now, the scenario I just described is if things go well. If things don't go well, sometimes these patients create some sort of disruption in the hospital. They break something, they become loud and boisterous, and sometimes they land in the very worst place possible for them, and that's jail. I'll get to more on that in a minute. Another difficulty that we're experiencing in rural Minnesota is the ability to recruit and retain good police officers, deputies and police officers. What makes it even more difficult for us in the rural area is our inability to compete with metropolitan wages and salaries, or even the state patrol for that matter. Without a broad tax base to draw from, our counties are just not positioned well to pay those kinds of wages. And of course, that puts us at a disadvantage. Before I get to my next point, I'd like to talk to you about what's different between the delivery of law enforcement in the rural area as compared to the urban area. It's probably not news to you, but I think it's worthy of mentioning. Oftentimes, we in law enforcement across the state get painted with this broad brush, so to speak, but we really have two distinctly separate styles of policing. And the notion that what happens in the metro area or what works good for the metro area must also be good for or work good for outstate Minnesota. And unfortunately, in so many instances, that's just not true. So in rural Minnesota, like Renville County, I personally know, or my deputies know, the vast majority of the people that live here, that we interact with. Our kids go to the same schools. We patronize the same businesses. We see each other in the grocery stores. We attend the same churches. Most of the time, we know a lot about their families and their struggles and the things that are going on in their lives. And that's important to understand because it affects the way that we interact with them professionally. How we as law enforcement officers treat people in rural Minnesota matters because we will undoubtedly run into them again. If you've ever looked at the president's task force on 21st century policing, that describes how things work in rural Minnesota. Another difference between rural and urban is, as I mentioned, the number of police officers that we have on shift at any given time. In Renville County, we have between one and three deputies on generally. What that means is that when they arrive at any scene, our mightiest weapons are our mouths. With backup sometimes a half an hour or more away, we don't really have any choice but to de-escalate, if for no other reason, because we have to. It's for our own safety. With that said, another challenge that I'd like to talk to you about is the quantity and the substance of the mandated training for our police officers. We're charged with providing a huge amount of training to our cops. Some of it's one time, some of it is annual or throughout other periods of time. You probably know that we have OSHA mandated training, whether it's employee right to know or bloodborne pathogens or PPE or fire extinguishers or hazardous materials. We also have the state mandates, use of force and deadly force and armed control measures, empty hand control measures, range days with handguns, range days with alternate weapons. And now we have more crisis intervention and mental illness crises and cultural diversity, community diversity, autism, emergency vehicle operations. There's tons and tons of training. No, please understand that I see value in the vast majority of that training. But in rural Minnesota, we don't have rooms full of officers at shift change undertaking training updates. We only have those couple officers and deputies working at a time. And so seeing to it that every officer is compliant with the training requirements is becoming logistically more difficult. Excuse me. with that said, our other difficulty that goes along with training is the financial burden that it brings. I realize that the amount of post reimbursement for training is higher than it was. I also believe that's set to sunset, and even without it sunsetting, the amount of money that we actually spend far exceeds what we're being reimbursed at. So again, make no mistake, I understand the value of training, and good training is invaluable. Next, I was asked to briefly discuss crime trends for us in outstate, and you've already talked about it. For us in the outstate, the adverse effect that drugs continue to have on us and our society, I just can't overstate. Drugs, the drug trade, addiction, it's the root cause of so many crimes, person crimes, property crimes, the number of child protection investigations. Drugs are still raising havoc with us. In this part of the state, methamphetamine is most prevalent. Heroin is rearing its public head, its ugly head rather, from time to time. Cocaine appears to be on the increase, but again, methamphetamine is still the king. Our agency, others like ours, and the VSETs are seeing increased record seizures of the drug. We're doing everything we can to combat this, and honestly, we're doing good things, but this is a huge problem that we're really having trouble getting our arms around. The other trend that we're experiencing, and I'm just not sure there's a lot that we can do about it, is the folks being victimized by fraud and scams. It's a growing trend. There isn't a week that goes by that we don't take a report of a heartbreaking report of people who are losing big money. Earlier this week, I can tell you that a victim finally reported to us a scam, and she was out just over $300,000. That's not unusual. I mean, that's an exorbitant amount of money, but we've had those before. Although it's not a crime, we also are seeing an increase in the number of cases involving mental health. Our partners across the state, we are so super thankful for our state partners, including particularly the BCA. We rely on Superintendent Evans and his team for their lab and to a lesser extent their field investigation staff. You know, although we'd love to see shorter lab time, turnaround times and so forth, we know that they're stretched thin, but they do excellent work and we're certainly proud to partner with them. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fire marshal and the state patrol and Homeland Security and emergency management, all treasured partners. Working cooperatively is our nature. That's what we do. It's a constant. It's our culture in outstate Minnesota. Because we have so few officers and deputies working at any given time, we rely on our neighbors just like they rely on us. At the state level, at the local level, police departments helping the sheriff's offices helping the police departments. That's just what we do. We have this mantra across the state that says, no sheriff stands alone. And we mean it. If somebody needs help, we send any help we can get. Diversity, Chair Mariani, you talked about diversity and what it means. Outstate, operationally, I haven't seen a significant change or shift in how we operate as our communities become more diverse. Honestly, in Renville County, our community is not all that diverse. We have our most prevalent minority population is the Hispanic population, but that's been relatively stable. But how it affects us really isn't that much different, because remember, in outstate Minnesota, we live among our residents. We might be their neighbors. We might be friends. We just have so many things in common, and we're held accountable because we know them and they know us. Conversely, what we're not seeing is the folks in these minority groups studying for this profession and then applying for jobs with us. We're just not seeing those applications come in when we have openings. And then finally, I just want to talk to you for a second about the challenges associated with holding inmates in our jail and providing for their medical and mental illness needs. So many times we deal with this. Many of them receive medical assistance. That is right up until the time that they enter the jail. The Medicare inmate exclusion policy applies, and once they break the threshold of our jail, that's over. They become our problem, the county's problem. And I'm super passionate about doing good things for inmates and making sure that they're well cared for, We would never ever forego mental or medical health treatment because of money, but it can be costly. A couple of examples include a recent inmate, probably a year ago, who had cancer. He was on medical assistance right until he came to our jail. And at $30,000 a month for chemotherapy, that's a burden. It can happen anywhere, heart attacks. In rural Minnesota, you call an ambulance, we pay for it. You go to an emergency room, we pay for it. They fly that patient to the metro area, we pay for it. They go to surgery, we pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a state problem. I recognize that. It's something that needs to be corrected at the federal level, but any help we can get, I would treasure. So in closing and in summary, I hope I don't come across as being some doom and gloom guy and to tell you this sad story. That's not my intention at all. It's not. We have so many things to be thankful for in rural Minnesota. I know that the law enforcement profession took this really huge hit this last summer, including unrest across many places across the country. For us in rural Minnesota, honestly, the most significant impact that that had on us, the unrest, the defunding police rhetoric, was that it greatly increased the frequency of people bringing us rolls and donuts and paying for our lunch. It was okay, and we are okay. In our jails, we're focusing on true rehabilitation. We provide chemical dependency treatment right here in the jail. We're seeing our inmates get their GEDs and their high school diplomas, and my county and a few others are embarking on a new journey where we're going to start to create this initiative supporting children of incarcerated parents, trying to break this cycle of children becoming incarcerated right after their parents are. In rural Minnesota, honestly, we have it good. Despite everything that's happened, we're still doing what we're great at, delivering excellence in public safety to the people that we serve, the people that depend on us. They call us, they trust us, and they support us. So again, it's been my true honor to be among you today. I thank you for the opportunity, Chair Mariani and representatives, and I'm happy to stand for any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Sheriff Hable. I am privileged to have you in our committee, and I'm very thankful for the work that you do on behalf of your people there in Renville County, but also for the state of Minnesota. Thank you. I hope you can stick around because I know there are a few questions. But before we get to that, I do want to call up then Janet Ryder. And I apologize if I mispronounced your last name, Chisago County Attorney, County Attorney Ryder. And we don't have you on yet. Don't have a picture or a sound yet.
You hear me now?
I can hear you, and I can see you as well. Welcome.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Ryder. I'm the Chisago County Attorney. And I'm here today also as the current president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association represents all 87 counties. It's a professional organization of my colleagues who are working hard throughout the pandemic to make sure that the justice system continues to move and operate through these difficult times. Chisago County is located just northeast of the Twin Cities. We are a shoulder community, so in preparation for today's comments, I contacted several colleagues, one as far north as 150 miles north of the Twin Cities, and another colleague who is 100 miles south of the Twin Cities, just to get a little bit more information from them about what's going on in their counties. Additionally, Minnesota County Attorneys Association has had some robust conversations on a regular basis with all of our counties to share issues or trends that they're seeing. So some of this information is taken from those meetings that we've had. Trends that we are seeing in county attorneys' offices. I guess I would say that in the best of times, the justice system operates like a well-oiled machine, and the county attorneys offices and other prosecutors, including city prosecutors around the state, are right in the middle of that well-oiled machine. We're taking in the cases from our law enforcement partners. We're analyzing them. We're referring them onto the courts. And in that review and assessment of the cases, we're looking for resources and services to provide both to the offenders in the form of mental health or chemical dependency treatment, just as Sheriff Habel mentioned. We're also looking to provide services to victims. Anecdotally, we know that at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw reports that domestic violence was on the increase. And some of our partners have noted that, and we can certainly understand that when during the shutdown, people who were not able to go out and operate in their normal lives, that maybe they weren't able to go to work or go out in their regular activities, it forced a lot of people who were already struggling to have on additional issues. And that might include domestic violence within families. It also includes individuals who are struggling with their mental health to have that exacerbated by lack of those healthy routines that might have kept them out of the out of a mental break. Similar to what the sheriff mentioned, chemical dependency is really a driver in many of the cases that we see all over the state. And I would echo what Sheriff Habel said, that methamphetamine is really still really prevalent and continues to be abused within our rural communities. I noted that the report from the BCA earlier that there is a decrease in the number of labs in Minnesota, but certainly that has not correlated with a decrease in the prevalence of methamphetamine. Additionally, we've talked for years about the opioid epidemic, where folks have been addicted to prescription medications and then turn to heroin or other illicit drugs to feed their addiction. We were just speaking earlier this week with other county attorneys about the prevalence of fentanyl, a drug that is not prescribed in any legal dose. It's obtained on the dark web or over the internet and always obtained illicitly. What is dangerous about fentanyl and carfentanil is the potency and the way that it cannot be cut or diluted the way that other controlled substances might be. And we're really seeing a large increase of overdose deaths as a result of fentanyl in our communities. From our perspective, we are also, you know, while sometimes over the summer, I think that law enforcement was focusing on larger, more significant crimes, we continue to see an uptick in the traffic deaths on our highways, the increase in really high rates of speed on both our interstates and our local county roads has really resulted in some interesting speeding tickets, as well as, unfortunately, some deaths. One of the questions that I was asked to speak about today was how the work has been impacted by COVID-19. COVID-19 pandemic has prompted a sea change in the way that our justice system is working and probably how it will work into the future. And I will say that there are some positive things that have evolved as a result of it, but some things might continue to be central to the way we operate our judicial system going into the future. Many county attorney's offices have the option of working remotely or have reduced staff within their offices to prevent the spread of the virus. And I would say that's a huge recognition of the other folks who work for county government, including our IT departments, who within a very short period of time were able to roll out a large amount of technology to help us in these keeping to do the work that we do. And that includes prosecuting crimes, addressing mental health through civil commitments and holds, continuing to serve children who are the subjects of child protection proceedings. So that is really something that's quite noteworthy, is how we've been able to do that even with the pandemic. One of my colleagues noted that the COVID-19 pandemic had caused a change in the way that they handle warrants out in greater Minnesota. In the past, anybody who was caught or picked up on a warrant in another adjacent or far distant county, that county would contact the county where the crime occurred. It would require a deputy or a transport officer to drive hours perhaps to pick up that person only to bring them to the county where the crime occurred for a 10 or 15 minute hearing. And then you have an offender sitting in the county where they don't have transportation and maybe they don't even have resources. And while it allowed, that was a very, you know, burdensome process to have people responding to warrants that were issued in other counties. Now, through the use of technology that has been really well accepted in all of our courts virtually, a person picked up in one side of the state can log on to their virtual hearing in the county on the other side of the state, have that address, have their warrant addressed, have them given a new court date, and it has spared both the resources of transport officers being on the road for hours, the expenses to our sheriff's office, as well as the risks to public safety of transporting individuals on the roads or even exposing our transport officers to the virus. So that is one thing that has been a positive, and we anticipate that perhaps that will continue and be a blessing that has flowed from the COVID-19 situation. The next thing that I've been asked to speak about is the backlog of cases and how we envision that those will be addressed.
And County Attorney Ryder, I do apologize. I always have to play the bad guy. But I do want you to make that point, but I also want us to get the questions quickly here because we have about 14 minutes left here. So please continue.
The point that I was just going to make is that we'll have a backlog. Every county is looking at hundreds or up to tens of thousands of cases. It will take everybody involved in the criminal justice system to really make a concerted effort. What we see is that both our defense bar, the courts, and prosecutors are all going to have to change the way they do things. We are seeing varying levels of cooperation from the defense bar. We're seeing the courts invest the time and resources of retired judges to handle additional calendars, but these are all being handled remotely that cannot handle the volume that we used to see even on a regular day. So just wanted to make note of that. This will take years for us to see the end of the backlog that has been created by this virus. And then just quickly on victims and their access to courts, we've seen both positives and negatives there. Just on a positive side of things, if a victim wants to take part in the hearing regarding her domestic abuser, she is able to log on to a virtual hearing, not be in the same physical space as her offender, which I think is a very significant public safety benefit. It reduces the incidental contact that might occur in a government center. So if that can continue, even as we go into in-person hearings here in 2021, I think that can continue to benefit victims in our criminal justice system. So I'll close with that and stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it. And thanks for, I've learned a few things here. I had not been thinking about this boomerang effect, you know, once things, you know, reopen. I totally get that that's going to be an incredible challenge for us. So, members, I've got four lined up. Let me just call you off and ask you to be as brief as possible with our excellent testifiers here. Representative Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. I'm trying to be quick. I've had a few things now. back to Sheriff Habel, I wanted to say that I really appreciate what you shared when you made the statement that your sheriff offices are community members and that the people that you protect and serve are part of the community. I think relationships like that are vitally important. I sit on a city council in my city, which is just a city of 20,000. And I know that the relationships that some of our offices have with community drastically impacts and changes how they interact when they come out on calls. And many things are de-escalated because of those relationships. So as a part of 21st community policing, that's absolutely dead on. And I'm glad that you're doing that. I would also suggest, though, when you mentioned that the lack of diversity that you may have, you didn't give numbers, and I don't know if you have it, but maybe a recruitment plan, maybe reaching out to some of those community members, getting them engaged in some ride-alongs, you know, just some way to get that to just engage those folks about those potential careers. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Chair, if I could now, here's a question I have. So back to superintendent and then the director of the first presenters. Thank you for that information. I did have a question going back to the issue around man caps around line three. My question is, just because there's not man caps, because those permits require them not to be around, that does not in itself mean that there's not sex trafficking around or sex for sale around those areas. Correct.
Superintendent Drew, are you still with us here?
Chair, this is again Katie. I am also the negative Nelly of the day, and I have to tell you that Superintendent Evans did have to drop off. I would say, Representative, I do think that he acknowledged that there was sex trafficking happening across the state of Minnesota, and that it did not, nobody got a pass on that. But I don't know if Director Weeks had anything she would add to that, but I apologize, Chair, that Superintendent Evans had to drop.
And for the record, that's Kate Knudsen with the Department of Public Safety. I don't know if Ms. Weeks wants, Director Weeks needs to comment or wants to.
No, that covers it. Thank you, Chair.
All right, very well. Representative Huot.
I want to go real quick. Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the Sheriff Havel, you and I have worked together closely in the last 2 years. And we're looking at opportunities over on the MSRB board. In fact, as this conversation went on, I just got my next year appointment. So we're going to be colleagues for a while longer. Anyways, I want to pull back to where Vice Chair Fred Frederick said that it is true that many of officers around the state are engaged in the community. But I also want to point out, and I'm sure your county is no different, many of your officers also go on to going home, putting on a pager, responding to ambulance calls as a volunteer, or possibly fire calls. Is that true? I mean, can I say that's a pretty good statement there? I'm worried about burnout here is what I'm going at, but is that a true statement, Sheriff Abel?
Sheriff Abel.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Representative Hewitt. That is an absolutely fair statement. And I would say probably almost 50% of our staff at the Sheriff's Office volunteers in some way in other emergency services.
So, and Mr. Chair, and thank you. And I want the committee to realize that we're tapping the same sources over and over again to subsidize other first response services. And that's going to come up over and over and again in our committee. And then the last statement that I want to say, and I know Sheriff Havel and I have had this discussion about recruiting minorities, even though his county is not as big as maybe Kandahoe next to him, but we've talked about this both in EMS and that, and we actually had a good discussion about looking at getting into our schools and what we're going to do to try to get more of our students interested in public safety, because that's a job of both of ours. So I look forward to working with you. I have other questions, but I'm going to hold off for give my other time to the other people. Thank you, Chair.
I really appreciate that. If there's still time, I'll come back to you as again. And I didn't give Representative Frazier an opportunity for a follow-up, so I might be able to do that as well. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Sheriff Cable. I had the honor of representing a rural county in counties in Minnesota, and have a great relationship with our sheriff. And he told me about the No Sheriff Stands Alone. So as you're saying that, it just really touched my heart because of the fact that that's something that is so prevalent and is so lived out in our sheriffs. My question is, you talked about how demanding all of the mandated training is. Forgive me since I am new, if this question has been asked and maybe answered previously, are all those trainings required to be in person? Meaning, do you need to bring a presenter down and have a person actually train your officers in a person-to-person setting? I know COVID was probably different, But in normal situations, is that something that has to happen?
And Representative Mueller, please know that even if a question was asked in a prior session, no question should not be unasked. You weren't here as a rep back then. You're a rep now, and so you should absolutely be able to ask these questions. And Sheriff Hable, this did trigger some thoughts for me as well. What I wrote down in my notes was, you know, sort of question mark, you know, should we be looking at ways to constantly reform how training is delivered? And I also do think that there is this sort of natural bias to, like, provide training once and it's done. But it seems to me it's the quality of the training more in term than the issue of even how often or how much. And maybe in there lies some opportunities. But I'm sorry, I'm not trying to distract from Representative Mueller's question. But please, sir, if you can venture in.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Mueller. Chair Mariani, you're spot on. The quality of training is different from source to source. There is no mandate that you get training from a particular source or a particular place or vendor. To answer the previous question about whether it needs to be in-person training, most of it does not. And so COVID offered little disruption to a lot of that training. Some of the training does have to be in person. The range training, firearms training, pursuit driving, emergency driving training, those are all hands-on types of environments. So again, but I hope I didn't come across as suggesting that the training was not valuable. It is. The point I was trying to make was the amount of training is quite a bit. It's for a small agency like ours, difficult logistically to get all of that training accomplished every year, and then the financial burden that it brings is great as well. I hope that answered the questions.
Yeah, thank you, Sheriff Hable. You know, as I listened to both you and to our Chisago County Attorney Janet Rader, you know, I'm struck by two notions. You know, one is that it does seem like we have more alike than indifference in terms of what our challenges are and what we're called to do. At the same time, it's really important for us to be distinctly aware of the distinct dynamics that exist in our communities. And some of those are, you know, not even technical. They might just well be cultural. You know, I'm really struck by this notion of people living in small communities where they're going to run into someone pretty regularly as opposed to occasionally. We have one more question, members, and then we'll adjourn. But in case I run out of time, I just want to make sure that I'm expressing my deep gratitude to both the County Attorney Rider and to Sheriff for being with us here today. So with that, members, Representative Johnson, you have the last question.
Chair Mariani, members, first of all, I want to thank County Attorney Ryder for being here. If you don't know that, she covers part of my district, and it's always a pleasure to have her with us down here. And I want to congratulate her on being the president of the association. And I also want to thank Sheriff Hable for being here. He showed the true distinction between what happens out in greater Minnesota and the metro area, and how some issues that you do have here, we have the complete opposite issue, and how the policies they put in place here hurt us out there, but the policy we use might actually hurt you here. So we have to look at it that way, and we can't have just one policy because we're so different. And with that, I'm going to end there. I just want to thank them for being here. And I would like to give an opportunity for Representative O'Neill to make that statement she was promised last Tuesday.
Well, Representative Johnson, just as you were chair of this committee once, I'm chair of this committee. And, you know, it's really up to the chair to make that determination. We have 1 minute left. And so, Representative O'Neill, if you can say what you need to say in 60 seconds, that'd be wonderful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply wanted to set the record straight from, I think it was two committee hearings ago, we had someone from the NAACP state that white supremacists burned down Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so I had never heard of anything like that before. So I did a pretty extensive search and could not substantiate that claim. I did find some articles that talked about rumors and innuendo, but nothing substantiated. So I just wanted to correct the record. And I appreciate you giving me the time to do that. That's all I have.
I appreciate you sharing your perspective. I would not say it's correcting the record as much as adding your opinion to what was put on the record by a member of a predominant longstanding civic association in our nation and in our state. But duly noted, you're on the record. Members, with that, again, I want to thank our testifiers today. It's been enlightening, and I'm greatly appreciative for everyone's work, both at our state level and our local public safety providers. Members, we will meet again tomorrow at our standard time. And so until then, this committee stands adjourned.